accession number 23197 real.
Mrs. Jimmy Lane, Reel One. If I could ask you, first of all, to tell me something about your family background.
My family background. We're a Scottish family, and as with a lot of Scots, we had to leave Scotland and go other places because of the clearance of the Highlands and all the things that happened then. And the first lot, I think, went straight to India and was an officer in what they called then John Company, and served there. And then I'm not quite sure why another member of the family went to the West Indies, to Jamaica, married there. They had sugar plantations, and that was fine for a while, but then they produced sugar beet, and the sugar plantations died. And I don't know quite when he came back to Scotland, but that's where they settled later, near Paisley, in a village called Johnston. And they lived there comfortably, I think, and got involved in local affairs and became to do with what we would now call the county councils and things like that. Vaguely political, but not very. But the next bit that I really know anything about is my great-grandfather, Alexander Dunlop, who joined the ICS in India. And after some years of service, he was seconded to HEH, the Nizam of Hyderabad, as an advisor. And that's where he lived the rest of his service life. And of course, coming home on leave was difficult then, because about every 4 years, because the journey took a long time, though by the end of his service, there was the Suez Canal to go through, and that hurried things along. I only learnt the other day that they had a daughter. They had two sons, my grandfather and another son, my great uncle Will, who was lovely. But they also had a daughter, and it's only very recently that I heard that she fell overboard coming through the Bay of Biscay. Extraordinary thing. I never heard, all the years we knew each other, that there had been this child, which was an extraordinary accident, and extraordinary the way it was kept hidden, really. My father went out to India at the end of the First World War, and joined HEH, the Nizam's State Railways, first of all as a railwoman, and was often away because they used to go to outlying districts and so on. And my mother came out and joined him with my sister, leaving my brother behind because they'd been advised that India wasn't a very good place to bring up small boys, which I think was nonsense. But there it was, and it was very sad because they didn't see him again for 4 years, and he lived with my grandparents in Scotland. They had a good life there, I think. At one stage they lived in a place called Jalna, which is immortalized in a book, I think, by Mazo de la Roche. And they were the only Europeans there. And my father, who was mad about animals, kept everything from a tiger to monkeys. But my mother put her foot down about snakes. That she would not have. Anyway, he once had a small crocodile, which he kept in Indian bungalows. You always had a big, what we called a tank, where the water was stored for the gardeners to water the plants. And he had this crocodile in here, a baby one. But it disappeared, and nobody ever knew where it went. And that sort of thing. My mother was lonely, I think, with no one to talk to, but she had her piano and she loved that. She said it was always a great comfort. Then, in the mid-30s, he was transferred from the railway bit to the part that dealt with road transport. And Hyderabad State is the size of France. And they had buses and things that went all through the state. And he enjoyed that very much because then he was his own boss and didn't really have to answer to anyone. They came home on leave in 1939 and took a small cottage in Somerset, which they loved. And then war was declared and my father was called back. So both my sister was there then, and Mummy said that we couldn't leave this 15-year-old alone in London with only really a very elderly grandmother. And so they had an agreement that if the shipping line could find a berth for me, I could go. Otherwise, bad luck. And I can remember waiting with fear and trembling for the result of his visits to the shipping office. And he came up to my grandmother's flat in Greenock, where we lived, and said, "It's all right, she can go." And the voyage was great fun, actually, to a 15-year-old. Once we got, we sailed from Liverpool in convoy. A little worried, I think they were, because the aircraft carrier Courageous had just been sunk, and we had a dear young friend who went down with it. He was in the Fleet Arrow, and that was a sad leaving. And we sailed way out into almost mid-Atlantic in convoy. I suppose it was to keep all the ships together. And then when we reached, I suppose, a line going towards Gibraltar, that's where we headed for. And went through, I never forget, the first sight of the rock. Great. And then through the Mediterranean. Ship was blacked out. But it was fun, and we got to Portside, and that was a great experience. I had been there as a child, but it's where you always bought your topi when you were going on to India. So we did that, and then arrived at Bombay, which was there was no blackout in India then. In fact, I think until the Japs walked into Burma, the only places that were blacked out were places like Calcutta and all on the east of India. The whole of the rest of the subcontinent was lit up pretty well too. So that was that, and we arrived in Hyderabad, and I did very little for the first few months I was there.
Before you go on and tell me about your life, you know, this would be returning to India after the war, could I ask you a little more about your early life?
As a schoolgirl?
Yes, and as a young child, you know, in
India.
Hyderabad, yes.
Well, it's fairly dim, I think, my recollections, except that I was spoilt, I think, by my parents, because I was the first one they'd had all the time when they were little together. We had a governess, and I treated her abominably, I think, because not because I was nasty to her, but because I persuaded her that other things were more interesting than learning to read and write and so on. And her name was Mrs. Chick, and she was Anglo-Indian, married to a sergeant in the army. And eventually they came home, and I remember her writing to my mother and saying, "We are living round the corner from the church." Don't know where it was. Anyway, she was lovely, but I didn't learn anything from her except that it was fun. You know? And I can remember being taught to whistle by a little Indian boy who was our cook's chokra, and he taught me how to whistle. I can remember that very clearly. And swimming in the club swimming pool was lovely, and having a pony, and of course always a mass of animals. Who then became my father's brother-in-law, he married my father's sister when he first arrived in Hyderabad. He was early for his first appointment, and the taxi driver took him on a little tour. And as they passed my parents' bungalow, he pointed it out and said, "This is Dunlop Saab's zoo." So we were always animal man, all of us, I think.
Were your parents living in the same place?
Yes, then.
What was it called?
Well, the first one I mentioned was Jalna, where Dunlop Saab Zoo was, in a piece of a sort of suburb, if you like to put, not quite like that, but it was outlying. It was called Chilcagudo, which is where I was born. My earliest memory, and I can't have been more than 2 and a half, because after that we went to live in another bungalow in another part of the well, just round the corner, obviously, a bit, but it was bigger. But I remember this one because I had one of those silly little tricycle things, you know, and I bicycled along the veranda and fell off the far side, and that, I think, is why I remember it. And that must have been when I was 2 and a half, because they moved after that. Then I stayed there until just before I was 7, when they brought me, they were coming home on leave, and they decided they would have to leave me in Scotland after that, because by another 3 years had gone by, I was getting on, you know.
Apart from the governess, you know, and your education.
Yes.
Mrs. Chick. Who lived near the church.
Yes.
later. What sort of childhood was it?
It was lovely. It really was. I think, yes, I was spoilt. It was just, I can remember very little, really, apart from bits. I had an Aya to look after me, and I spoke Telugu to her and was horror-stricken when I went back to find I couldn't remember anything at all about it. It had all gone. And, you know, we rode a pony with the syce with me, and my sister was at home at school then, so I had no companions. There were a number of children around, and there were marvellous parties at the Scandabad Club for Christmas, when they always laid on something. Well, one year it was an elephant, and another year it was a camel, and we all had rides, you know. And that was just great. And it was, I think, a cultural shock when I went back to Scotland and to school.
I was wondering how much contact there would have been with the Indians. Am I right in thinking this would now be Pakistan?
No. Unfortunately, it's India still. They took it in after 1947, when India began. And Hyderabad had its own private army, which it had done sterling service for the United Kingdom in both world wars. Batteries of artillery, foot soldiers, and so on. And there was a treaty between HEH, the Nizam, and the British government after, in Clive's day, really, when there were all these inter-battles, and Hyderabad came to the aid, and I can't remember the date, of the British to oust, what was he called? Somebody or other, Saab, the Indian, and it was a big battle. And as Hyderabadi Indians and English won. And the treaty gave a promise that Hyderabad would always be helped by the British government. And I've always felt rather ashamed of when the fact that it was annexed by India, that nothing was done. My husband says it's silly because they had no access to the sea, and they were completely surrounded by India. But it's always stuck in my craw that nothing was done. And of course, I feel that the whole position of India in 47 was, it was so hurried to give everybody self-government. I think Mountbatten wanted to have the kudos and quickly.
So this was an Indian state.
Oh
then.
Yes, HEH Nizam was at that time, I think, the richest man in the world. And he was a funny little man. He was a Persian poet. He wrote beautiful poetry. He was had a whole zenana full of wives. We always were told he had 200 second-class sons. And daughters weren't mentioned. He had two proper sons by the Begum, and one of them eventually acceded. But HEH was wasn't interested in riches as such. He used to be driven around in a very ancient motor car, just wearing an ordinary sherwan, and I remember once at a polo match he came, and he had a large iron mark in the back of his coat. And he couldn't care less. But they used to say we had a famous girls' school in Hyderabad called Mahbubia, which had all English teachers in it. It was the sort of Rodin of India. And they all said that the Hyderabadis kept their pretty daughters at home when H.E.H. was making a visit.
What was his full title, his name?
Let me think. Moinir Dowler, wasn't he? I can't remember his first name, but that Dowler was the sort of important, that was the sort of, what's it called? And you know, this is like the Windsors or the Windsors, that was the family name, as it were.
And you spell that D?
Dowler. It's always a bit phonetic. You could do it D-O-U-W-L-A or any way you like, because it's only being turned into English.
Yes, that must have been a fascinating childhood.
Oh, it was wonderful. I can remember my mother going to parties and coming back with bits that were presented. They ate off pudding plates made out of marzipan and gilded, you know, and these over-the-top bits. And my great-grandfather had been given as a ward a chap called Salav Jung, whose family was the hereditary prime minister of the state, and he was an orphan, and my great-grandfather had him as his ward, and actually did him very well, because he was left with an awful lot more money than he had when he was placed in my great-grandfather's care. And he was a remarkable man. He did a lot for the state. But
I notice you have the name Bruce.
Yes.
In your name. Now, is there a connection? Is that significant at all?
What, with
no, is there a relative, Bruce?
Now?
Or was there?
Oh, there always was. In each generation there was a Bruce. I can't understand why my father and mother didn't call my brother, who is Alistair, Bruce Alistair, but I suppose they don't know. I don't know why they didn't do that. I never found out. But I have my brother's son is Bruce, and my father's younger brother has a Bruce as well. And there was another feminine Bruce. My great-great-aunt was also Bruce, called Boo. She was the one who kept a python in her conservatory. Well, yes, Bruce as a forename in the family has been there. I am the 22nd Bruce in a direct line from Robert the Bruce, who only had a daughter, so it was down the distaff side. That was, and as I say, I had this aunt, great aunt, who was also Bruce. And I think people are amused by the fact that she kept a python in her conservatory.
How did you feel, you know, being left away from your parents when you came to the United Kingdom at the age of seven?
It's difficult to remember. I felt I went to school in Edinburgh, where my sister was. And for the first year and a half, I was very happy there. I think because I was the youngest child at school and the headmistress spoilt me. They had a change of headmistress, and there was a fearsome lady who came, and I was frightened of her. And I didn't like it at all. I was extremely miserable, and I think I had a psychosomatic illness. They had to take me away. My mother came home and had to take me away, and I had a governess again, where I learnt more perhaps in the year and a half that she taught me than I ever learnt before or since.
That was in England.
That was in Scotland. Always in. Well, not. Eventually, I went to school in East Sussex, in Northam, at an amazing place called Brickwall, where was headmistress was. A Mrs. Heath. She had been a Guinness when she was young and had travelled very extensively through Africa and South America with her father, part of the time being carried in, what do you call those things, almost like a sedan chair, but you could lie down in them. And she said the thing that kept her sane was that she couldn't read, there were no books, but she could remember all the poetry she'd ever learnt. And she used to intone. And she was a wonderful woman, a wonderful teacher. Really quite eccentric, but good influence on everybody, I think. It was a very happy school, not too big. We had a Russian lady who had come out in 1917-18, called Tamara, who looked after the school's feeding and taught us all about how to appreciate food, I think. That wasn't school grub at all. We're very lucky.
Were most of the children there from India?
No, only a few, or other places. I mean, you know, great colonial empire we were, weren't we? No, a lot of them were. We had one or two day girls, but it was only about 40 people, you know. It was quite small. There were service children there. But
did you get homesick there?
I got miserable, I think, when people went out. When people went home for weekends and half term, I think. But there again, they did well by us by arranging treats and things, you know. Well, we used to go to Rye, which is lovely, and I can remember the great thing was an enormous peppermint bullseye, which was or a humbug, I think, would be more the peppermint. Which we bought for sixpence, and it lasted for days sucking it. and we were allowed animals there at school, which was a good thing. I had a cat, which actually was my sister's, as she'd gone there before me, and it was called a ginger tom called Bruce, which everything had to be Bruce. And we had a ferret, which was called Bolton, and we kept goats and milked them. And that was. I remember trying to make cheese under my bed with some goat's milk in a tennis sock, going into the bucket that you were supposed to keep by your basin. You know, not very sort of a bit impure, I think. But that it was lovely, and I always went to some relation for long holidays, but not in the little ones. I had a grandfather who lived in Bedford, and I went there, and I used to stay with him on the way back from Scotland because the train journey, and I changed and went to Bedford with him, and then up to London and down to school.
It would seem that parents, you know, who worked in India and lived in India, there was quite a sacrifice.
I think my mother found it terribly difficult to leave her children behind, and for such a long time. And it wasn't like now, where the children get flown here, there, and everywhere. I remember her telling me that a kind person said to her, "Well, think of it this way: you can always find a good person to look after your children, but it's only a bad woman who'll look after your husband." I think that was probably quite true.
So would you have gone back to India at all?
Oh, I think so. Oh, yes. As an 18-year-old, you know, at the end of school, before one decided what you were going to do.
Yes. But did you go back for holidays?
Never.
From the age of seven?
No, not until I was 15 plus, when the war started. I can remember, though, 1938, when there was the panic over Czechoslovakia, being a little bit worried that there was going to be a war and I was here and they were there. But of course Mr. Chamberlain sorted it out.
Yes, I can see why you were pleased to be going back.
Oh, yes. And I still still love it. I think I'm a Scottish, well, I won't say Indian now, but from the subcontinent, because we have ties with Pakistan as well. And good friends, and it's all a bit worrying right now.
Yes, it's very much in that area, isn't it, Hyderabad?
No, Hyderabad's south.
Of Pakistan, yes.
No, south of India. I mean, it's almost... The next state down is Madras. You go from Bombay, you go down that way to Hyderabad. And it's quite high in places, though we had hot weathers. I mean, it would be 116 or something like that. But we always had a coolish night, which was always the saving grace. In the Punjab, you have a hot day and night in the hot weather. And we were always able to... We slept out during the hot weather, and mosquito netted, of course. But you got a bit of a breeze always, so you could sleep. And
so going back in 1939, what was that like?
Wonderful. Mm. Everything, of course, as it does if you go back to places you knew as a child, looked much smaller. I can remember thinking, I could remember that tree, but I'm sure it was much bigger then. But no, it was good. And we'd always had the same servants for years, so they'd known me as Missy Baba. Now I was just the Miss Sub, you know. I actually found a picture of Parbaya, who was, in inverted commas, butler, you know. And he went to my family as a 12-year-old and retired just after my parents came home in, what year did they come home? 47. So it would have been a long time if they'd left me at home. Too long.
So what were your plans having returned to India? Were you going to continue your education?
I think that's what my father thought. they got me a little Babu to teach me shorthand and typing because they thought that would be useful. I don't know why they didn't think of sending me to Mahbubia, which was a good school. But no other European children there, so maybe they thought of that. Not that we ever had anything but more than good relations with... We had Indian friends always.
Did you?
Oh, yes.
How about the Anglo-Indians? You know, how did they fit into society?
Well, Anglo-Indians, especially in the life that we had, most of the Anglo-Indians then were almost... blue-collar workers, could you use them? Or they were in the service of the railway, but not, it sounds awful to say, but not in the same category as other people. And when I had my first child, I had a lovely little Anglo-Indian nurse whose father was, I think he was a guard or something on the railway, and she had gone and took... And she was Marvis maternity nurse. Avis Rosario, she was called. Never forget her. But no, we're Indian friends, both Hindu and Muslim and Sikh, everything. There was never any feeling in Hyderabad of a difference between the religious bits of being whether you're a Muslim or anything. And we were lucky. We met interesting people like Mrs. Naidu, who was one of Nehru's top women, and a wonderful man who actually was the father-in-law of a Parsi friend, which did make for difficulties because marrying out of your religion was more difficult than you. I think people intermarried into their own thing, but. She was a very strong-minded girl, and they were engaged for years before they finally married. And her father-in-law was a man called Abdul Ghaffar Khan, who was called the Gandhi of the North. He came from, maybe it was part of Afghanistan. No, I don't think so, but well up in the north, near Quetta, I think. And there was a great haroosh about that when they got married.
Yes, I suppose the caste system.
Well,
two
entirely different religions too. You know, being a Muslim and being a Parsi were very different. The Parsis arrived in India from Persia, and that's where the name came from. But always interesting and always fun too. We had some Indian friends who had been the previous summer to come to Europe on a holiday, and these two very beautiful girls showed us the hats they'd bought in Paris and had worn there. Here they were in saris with these silly little hats on their heads. You could just see what they were having and how they enjoyed Paris and London. But and then, of course, had arranged marriages, but which all seemed to work very well.
With entertaining, you know, when your mother entertained, were there very strict rules, you know, the hierarchy of who, you know, belonged to what?
No, I don't think so. I think the only thing one was concerned about is the dietary things that you knew what not to feed somebody on. You would no more think of, you know, pork or shellfish. They're not, and that's all the same as Jewish, because it was a health thing rather than no reason. There was a reason. It was because.